Hi, I'm Linda. I'm an alcoholic. Hello, can everybody hear me? Great. And I'm grateful to be here. My sobriety date is July 30th, 2000. I have a home group. It's the We Group. And I have a sponsor. And her name is Rosie. And I'm really honored always to speak at an AA meeting. And this one especially, I used to go to this meeting a lot, and I feel like a lot of people I know here, and I just really respect this meeting and Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, so I'm a local girl. I wasn't born here. I was actually born in Pittsburgh, so shout out to Pittsburgh, wherever you went. Yay, Pittsburgh. But my mom was on the run from my dad. She was, like, running away when I was born. That's why I was there. We were from Philadelphia. We were the kind of a family that the whole extended family, everybody lived in, you know, the same house or the neighbor's house and those row houses in Philadelphia, in Fishtown, actually. And so my father, I suspect, I never came to find out for sure, but I suspect is alcoholic, and my mom is mentally ill. But by the time I was three, we had, I think there was like, yeah, there's five kids in the family. I was the middle child. The youngest was 7 months. The oldest was 7 years. My dad got a job in California, San Francisco, because he had put himself through school, finally got a job, put us in a station wagon, drove us out to San Francisco, and promptly died. And so my mom was like, with all these kids in another, you know, so all this stuff happened by the time I was 3 years old. And I just, you know, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. But it changes my worldview a lot, and I believe that all that stuff happened before I could even speak, and so there's like a lot of times there's issues, and I don't even know what they are, but you know I suspect you know that you know I'm just used to that whole ooh, everything's happening so fast thing, so. So I grew up in North Park. I don't know if anybody knows. Well, everybody knows North Park. Not that far. And it's a beautiful. I love it. It's a great place. When I was a kid, it was mainly single parents with a bunch of rowdy kids. We were the North Park Stoners. And I had two brothers. Let's see. What happened was when my dad died, the family got split in half because my mom took the body back east and they fought for the kids and there was all this ruckus and she took the ones that could walk and lucky me, I could walk. And I believe that the other two dodged a bullet, but maybe not. I don't know. She brought us to North Park and she bought a little house and we lived there and I was just invisible. I was the invisible child. I was the lost child, I guess they would call it in the little, you know, other kind of. And I remember that. Like, I don't remember myself. I remember everybody else, but I don't remember me. And not very many people, because you can reach them all on by Facebook now, and they don't remember me. They're like, yeah, I remember your brothers. And so, I remember you. So I was really successful at that coping mechanism as just being invisible. And then about 11 years old, my mom got arrested. She had found shoplifting, and she brought me along, and we would shoplift. And she got arrested, and they sent her to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist had this big picture of Sai Baba. I don't think anybody knows who that is, but he just passed, by the way. And he was the Messiah in India. So she, like, was very impressionable, crazy lady. So she was like, okay, I'm going to India. So she sold the house, and we weren't invited, which was cool with me. And I was like, fine, you know, I can make it on my own. And at the same time, I remember, because we had, she had sold the house, and the people were to take possession of the house the next day. So my brother and I went to Tuba Man's with some friends. And Tuba Man's was a place where you could, you know, play pool and eat pizza. And out of a big gulp cup, I had a 7 and 7, which tasted like 7-Up to me. and out of a straw, because I, you know, learned from those people to drink it as fast as you, that's how you drink, right? You drink out of a straw and you drink as fast as you can, and that's what I did. And I blacked out, and I woke up on the hardwood floor with them, you know, kicking us out. And the first, I remember, I'm like, I want to do that again. That was all I thought of. It's like, I'm going to do that again. I think, you know, like the whole world was turning around for me, and I was like about to be homeless, but I didn't care. I mean, I cared on what I, the whole thing was about now about escapage. You know, I was going to drink, and I was going to drink. And that's what I did. I like found some friends in Old Town now, because Old Town was great back then. Like, Old Town, San Diego, because they'd have the tourists during the day where we could panhandle, and then at night, you know, we just like buy a ton of beer and, you know, all the other party favors, and, you know, we would just try them all and do that all night and then pass out and wake up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and do it all over again. And I was with my friend, because my friend's mom, she was a heroin addict, so she was, like, really liberal, you know. So so that was working out for me. And so this is fine. This is great. I thought this is good, you know. And I lived, you know, we went to Presidio Park a lot. We went to, you know, we just had fun. And, you know, the years started going by and ticking by, and there was all this, you know, going on. And then I'm finding myself, you know, like I tried to go to school. I wanted to go to college. So I thought, well, I'll go to college, and I would support myself by, you know, selling pot. And I would do that. And, like, all these people, it was, you know, the guy that was the most likely to succeed, it was at Roosevelt, ended up, like, murdering somebody, and then somebody else I knew, and it was just, like, people were falling like flies, but I didn't really even think about that. I just knew I had to get out of there, and so I just partied, and it got pretty much, you know, I have to talk about this speech class I went to. I was in City College. I don't know why. This keeps coming up tonight. And I, you know, I really wanted to be like a public speaker, so I was like really into that. So I went, took the speech class, and I also smoked a lot of pot. And I smoked a lot of pot that day. And I went. I know it's an AA meeting, so but I drank most. And so I drove. I smoked a lot of pot that day, and I thought, oh, I'm late for my class. And I ran to my class. Right, it was really a weed. And I ran to my class, slow motion. And then I get there. And I slam open the door, and it's the class before my class. I wasn't late. And that should have been an indicator. Go home. You're too stoned. But no, I go. I think, well, I'll sit in the back of the class. And I sit in the back of the class. And, of course, the teacher picks up on it. She's so loaded. And he goes, you're going to do an impromptu speech today. And I'm like, oh, no. So I go to do it. And it's like, if you could go anywhere in the world, where would you go and why? And stupid. And so I go up there and I start to speak, and the first word out of my mouth is and the second word out of my mouth is and the third, and I keep saying this, that, and he goes, well, every time you say Linda, I'm going to drop my keys. So it's like drop, 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 until I started bawling and crying and ran out the door, and I never wanted to speak after that. And I never went back to that class, and I never went back to college, and I just, you know, partied. And I have to fast forward it a little bit to now I'm in my, you know, because I go through my 20s and nothing, you know, I have a daughter, you know, I'm like 25, and I get pregnant. And I go, I'm a barfly. Oh, my God, I'm a barfly. And I like to say that I, you know, slowed down or stopped or something like that. But the truth is, no, I did not. You know, I didn't. And I drank, and I kept getting bigger and bigger and drank. And I was at phone room. I worked in the phone rooms, like where I would sell trash bags for the VFW. And I mean, you got to buy them anyway, right? And this is going to help the guys. And you can leave the check under the mat. And back then they would. I mean, I swear to God, I would say, you have a doormat, right? And they'd say, yeah. And they'd put it under the mat. And then the driver would go around and pick it up. And I'd stay at the bar until they pick it all up. And they'd come back and give you cash paid daily. It was a great job. And then I'd pay the bar tab, you know, and be broke again. And we'd do it every day. And we were Jerry's kids because Jerry was under the table. Anyway, he was the boss. He was always flat under the table. He's passed. So but I'm going in the bar and they're like, Linda, you're bad for business. You know, you're like out to here. And I got 86 from my bar. And that was like devastating to me. Now what am I going to do? I guess drink alone. And that's what I did. I drank alone in a little, like, tiniest little room, and it was sad. I mean, it wasn't pretty. And I did try to stop drinking for a little while right at the end, so then I wouldn't get, like, you know, in trouble. And I couldn't work anymore. I thought, you know, even though I was managing the room, and I was like, well, I'm just not going to work anymore. I'm just going to get on AFDC, and I got on AFDC, and you know, and I had my baby, and I drank, and it wasn't good. And my grandparents kind of helped. And then I had another baby. It was a boy. And I had another baby. And just out there, just like an alien. Like I would see people, and they would be like over there, and then there would be me, and trying to keep those kids. And I lost them. They were taken away in 1996. My daughter, well, I had met the guy, this one guy that I dated him for a week, maybe a week, and I tried to get rid of him for 4 years, and he was hard to get rid of, and devastating, because he found all my friends and said, lose her number, and they did, and, like, people wouldn't talk to me anymore, and then only friends were his friends, and it was just, like, a whole nother world. It was pretty bad. And so in 1996, I think he went to prison, so I was all happy about that. So I found more trouble. And I had this apartment, and some things had happened, and it was a setup, but the main thing is I was attacked in an alley, and the guy turned around and told the police that I robbed him. Me and a black man with a knife robbed him with a knife. And I didn't even know all this happened, right? And I find out, like, 6 months later that I'm wanted, and at this time I was hanging out with a bank robber, so I'm like, that's weird, because he's robbing banks and I'm getting in trouble. Like, this is weird. So I mean, this really happened. So I'm like, okay, stay, find out what this is all about, fight for your kids, or go to Vegas with a bank robber. And I went to Vegas with a bank robber. We was like the only choice for an alcoholic, but I did know deep, deep down inside that I was letting my kids go at that point. And in a way, I was relieved. And it was sad. I knew that those kids needed something I didn't have. And wouldn't have for a while. And they were not going to, like, sit on the couch in their diapers waiting for me to get sober. So I didn't give them away. They ripped them out of my hands, claw, you know, And I didn't deserve them. So that was my, from 25 to 36, all that happened. And so here I am, I'm 36, it's been 3 years since my kids were taken away. And since they were taken away, I mean, I drank every day in the bar. I lived in a garage. I thought I had it going. I did. I had it going on for, you know, because I had, like, a garage, and I could kick anyone's ass. I'd try to get in my garage, and I had a broken mirror. I didn't break it, but it was a broken mirror, and it was cool, because then I had two mirrors, and I had one, the garage door would open like this, you know, and I would put one mirror here, my little bed here, one mirror here, and I could see up and down the alley. the cops were coming, right? And I lived in there, and I drank a lot, and I didn't get showers, and it was 3 years of hell, and I didn't care. I lost my kids. I had to drink that away. I had to drink so much. I just had to keep drinking, and I ended up in what is that area? City Heights. The only good step there was pretty much, you know, alcohol and crack. And I was, I had a little bandit place and a boyfriend, but the boyfriend got a settlement and I didn't know that's why he kicked me out, but he kicked me out and it was Valentine's Day and I was really upset because it was pouring down rain and I didn't have enough sense to get inside. I just walked up and down the street. What do I do? What do I do? Where do I go? I don't know what to do. And, just looking for relief, looking to get drunk and, couldn't find it. And I ended up going, thinking to myself, God, I'm homeless. I can be homeless anywhere. That's the good thing about being homeless is you can be homeless anywhere. You can go anywhere and be homeless. And that's what I thought. And I thought, I was an optimist. And I thought, well, I'm going to go. I'm going to the beach. And I went to the beach. I went to Oceanside. I got out of the area. I thought, I'll go to Oceanside. I homestead it. I call it the act, homesteading act of 1812, I think. And, you know, you share a little booze and then you get the couch and you don't leave. You just stake your ground. And that's what I did. They were like, I wonder where she's going to go. And I'm not going. They had a video game. And I remember playing video game for probably 3 months straight. And, and this is where it like got to where what happened. And then every time I would go out, because I was always under the influence, and the cops knew it, and the cops there seemed to like me, and that's how I was. I was really conceited. I thought that they liked me. I thought, well, these cops like me, because they kept arresting me. I got arrested every time I went out the door. Hadaman, they liked me, right? And the officer said, every time I see you, you're going to get arrested because you're always under the influence and I'm just going to arrest you. And I'm like, oh, great. And they did. Like, it had been like a month and a half and I think I was arrested like 6 times. I'm like, this is incredible. And I remember that day so vividly. This was in 98 because I did relapse in 2000. But in August of 98, I could not get high or drunk, and that's why I got sober. Well, what happened was I just couldn't. I was so mad. I mean, I was drinking, and I was watching other people drink. You know, I'm trying to, like, okay, they're drinking. I'm going to drink, you know, and I couldn't. I didn't feel it anymore, and I couldn't get high. There was no relief, not even a second of relief, and I was really mad, and I just got out, you know, of course. And I'm in my little motel room, and this junkie, like, taps on my window, and I'm trying to get high, and he taps on my window, and he says, Linda, come out here and help me. I got a needle in my arm. I got it stuck in my arm. I'm like, oh, ooh, I'll go out. So I run around, and there's that same officer. I called him Officer Nazi. and I'm mad. I didn't see it coming, but it's like, do-do-do-do-do. My eyes met his eyes. I knew I was going to jail. And just like that, I was done. I was done. And I was relieved. I felt this feeling of relief come over me. I mean, I was finished. I had no idea what to do. I was done. I had always had ideas before. In fact, I always fought the cops. I'd run. I'd fight them. I'd tell them, oh, you're divorced, right? Or just, you know, do something to really piss them off. But this time I just didn't. I was just like, I'm fine. And so I surrendered in the back of a cop car, and which I thought was apropos. So here I am. And getting arrested one more time. And I had been, arrested before for that armed robbery, but they let me go because they found out it was actually somebody that had, anyway, it was, but because of that, they had me pegged as a violent criminal, so they weren't offering me any program at all. But by this time, for some reason, and this is where God comes in because it's second in inches, at the exact same time I was done was the exact same time they offered me a program. And they offered me, maybe you can go to a program. And I was begging. I'm like, please. And I didn't want to go to the program for any, because I had done time before and I could always do time. Usually I'd rather do time. I was that kind of, you know, tough girl, whatever. And I didn't want to do time. I want it help. I want it out. And I wanted other people to tell me how to do this. And I'd never wanted that before. And so I sat in that jail, and it was almost like little miracles kept happening, you know, because it started 3 years prior. It started back when I was arrested for that armed robbery, and then let out, and then those 3 years of hell, because that's when all my dignity, everything was taken from me. And if those 3 years hadn't happened, I wouldn't have got to the point where this was, and I was ready. So, I'm like, I remember sitting in the holding tank because the program, it was drug court at the time, it was a new program, and they were supposed to come pick me up, and they forgot me, you know, which was fine with me. I didn't care. I wasn't complaining at all. I was singing in that holding tank, and I was happy, and I just knew, like, I had this feeling that everything was going to be all right, and I was going to be okay, and I had never been to an AA meeting yet. And that program told me right away I get out, right, and I have no idea what to do. And they told me to get to a meeting. And so I'm, like, still homeless, and I'm still, you know, I have no skills at all. I only know how to get high. So, of course, that's, you know, basically I get out of jail. It's kind of the first thing I do. And that was the last time. I remember drinking the beer, and I only had, like, about half of it, and I put it down. I was like, I'm done. But that's all I knew how to do. And so I got to a meeting. I sat in the meeting. Sometimes people go, oh, I didn't want to be here when I first got. I got to the meeting, and I was at home. I was like, ah, you know, like a cartoon. I was so happy. And it was at Jake's Place in Carlsbad. And I was helped by Brother Benno's, and I knew it. I was going to be. And they said that you had to be sober for 30 days before you can come into this program. And there was no program yet. They were just building it. It was in, you know, three blocks from the beach. And I was like, how am I going to do that? So I did spend that first 30 days homeless. And that's not so fun when you're sober. I'll tell you that much. And I won't give that up. I mean, if somebody would have said, well, just stay on my couch or, you know, I wouldn't have fought for it like I feel like I did. And that was part of the foundation that was built, because I went to that meeting. As long as I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, or I was at my little program, or I was on the bus to or fro, I was okay. But if I deviated one little bit, I was like, ah, you know, like panic. So it was just, you know, the God gave me the ability to get through those days. And I got to where I was in this program, and this little lady, I don't want to say her last name, but Rita B., I love her. She was the house mom. She had just came back. She just came here from Minnesota, and she was this little lady that, you know, really, so she just was, like, we were tight. And she helped me. I like basically put my hand in her back pocket and followed her around, and she took me to AA meetings. She showed me that there's fun in sobriety. And if I hadn't found that out really early, I don't know that I would have been able to stay, because I really didn't think that. I thought, oh, okay, it's over. And I loved it. I mean, she took me, I think in November, she took me to the Thanksgiving thing, you know, where we stayed, and she stayed there with me. She's not a newcomer. She didn't have to do that. She took me there, she stayed with me, and I had so much fun. And I met these people, and people gave me their number, and, like, all that, when I was at this alien before, you know, that was melting away. Now people were treating me like I was a human being. I was like, they don't know me very well. But I loved it. And early sobriety was awesome. Those first 30 days were hard, and I I went kind of from sponsor to sponsor. Rita was not my sponsor. She was my house mom, and she helped me, you know, learn a lot of things. But I knew I needed to get a sponsor, so I went to go get a sponsor, and I'm like listening for, you know, something I want. And this one lady, Diet Coke Debbie, she had a Costco card, and I'm like, whew, that's my sponsor. She's talking about Costco. I want that life, you know. And so I got my first sponsor, and she had a beautiful house in Carlsbad, this nice lady, you know, just so foreign to me. And I'm gonna, you know, like, she's, you know, because in drug court, they made you do your steps right away. So, like, we were doing our steps right away. Like, we had to boom, 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 do our steps, go to meetings, do all the stuff, and, or go back to jail. And that's really why I didn't not do it. I didn't want to go to jail. I didn't want to be embarrassed in front of my peers. That's why I'm sober today. So I go and I do the first step with her, and the second step, the third step. And then the fourth step, like, I get stuck on the fourth step. Like, I wrote a lot. I know somebody else talks about writing a lot. I wrote a lot, and a lot. And I conveniently forgot to put my mom, which was, like, the biggest one. So I did my fourth step to the best of my ability at the time, and that's what I feel is important. And I did that with her. I did the fifth step, and it was really hard for me because now I had picked this lady that has a Costco card, and here I am, you know, I have this, like, story that I think is just so, you know, serious and horrible, and she's just gonna not like me. But I tell her these things about me, and she just, that's funny. She laughs. And it taught me to not take myself so seriously and kind of be able to laugh at it. And that's what I needed, because, like, I had all this shame and taking myself so seriously, and I'm never going to, you know, do this right, and da-da-da. That's what kept me drinking. That's what perpetuated it. And then now I could, like, let that go. It was really a relief. So here I am in North County. There's my daughter, and she's in East County with my grandparents, because the other two were taken. They were adopted away, the younger two. But my daughter, they actually severed my rights for all my kids, but they accidentally severed her, not her, but she was left with my grandparents, and my grandparents were aging. So it was like, I was like 2 years sober. I'm going too far ahead. Sorry. Let me go back. I have to go back to when I was, because I had gone through this for the first year. Sobriety was really lucky for me. I mean, I had to work. Like, I went to work. My first job was at Carl's Jr., and they hired me. I was like, they hired me at Carl's Jr. I was dancing home. They gave me a pickle outfit. I was a pickle. Yay. And I worked at Carl's Jr. And it was awesome for the first, like, week. And then I'm thinking, Carl's Jr. I kept getting in the way when people were trying to throw stuff away because I'm trying to take out the trash, and I was like, oh, this is not, but I could handle it, you know, like, I could do that job, and I did it, and for like 6 months, and then I saw right next door was the Motel 6, and I thought, well, I'm going to try for that clerk job. And so I did. I got to be a clerk which was really great, at Motel 6. And I could, you know, because I was, like, inputting information. I was living at this recovery home through Brother Benno's, and three blocks from the beach. I mean, it was like heaven. I was, like, in this other world, really. And I had, like, now I'm working at the Motel 6. I'm the clerk. And I was a really good employee. I mean, I came to work every day. I stayed there. I wasn't in any trouble. I was doing my program. That was my main concern, was going to meetings. But I could work, you know, to support myself and save money to be able to move on my own. And I was doing really good. And they said, well, you know, Linda, we want to give you a promotion. And I'm like, great. You know, they were going to make me manager, like really quick. And then so they're like, okay, so we're going to take your application that you gave us, and we're going to run it. I didn't get anything of it. I'm like, okay. and they ran it, and I got fired. Because I didn't put everything on there. Thank you. And so, yeah, I'm a real big believer in telling the truth on the application. So, but I did put, like, some of it. I wasn't going to. If I put all of it, come on. I don't know. And, no. And then, so then, but luckily I got this job. And I got this job at, it was called MicroStar. And MicroStar, which sounds like Microsoft, but it's not. And then we sold software, which was, it was a good thing. You know, I didn't know a lot about computers, I'll have to tell you, but I didn't know about shareware, but it was actually shareware. Now I know. But I didn't know then, and my heart was in it, you know, because I didn't know. They could get all these programs for their computer, which we barely even knew what those were at that time, and they could get that. So I was selling that, and I was doing really well. I was like their top salesperson right away, and I was making 80 grand. I made 80 grand the first year, and I was like, sobriety stuff's pretty easy. You know? And I was going to meetings, you know, sitting in the back, socializing, and hey, you know, and all that. And it was Saturday. Oh, something had happened. I don't know what, but somehow, you know, I know this is a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but somehow one of those paraphernalia thingies, I'm not going to tell you what, got in the back of my refrigerator behind, because I just threw it in the back of my refrigerator. Somebody was by, that was an old reservation, because this is all about reservations. And I had gotten sober for the courts, and, you know, because I wanted to at the time, because I couldn't feel the drink anymore. And I put that in the back of my refrigerator, and so it was calling me at night, you know, and I was doing real well on the sales. But this day, hey, somebody from MicroStar. This day was really slow, and Dad had been calling me, so I went and I bought some booze, and I drank it. And within 24 hours, I am not kidding you, within 24 hours, I was fighting a hooker for the last hit of crack on Hill Street. And I'm like, how did I get here? Talking about the big book. Oh, and it was, I want to say that, you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to go to a meeting. But I got in a car thinking, I want to go get some more, because I immediately wanted more. And I got in the car that Brother Benno's had gave me, and I'm tending to go find some more, and I drove it to the Harding Street meeting. My car drove to the Harding Street meeting with me in it, and it parked. And I got out, and I went in, and it was a little bit, like 10 minutes till it started, and I started to tell everybody individually that I had gone out, and I'm a newcomer. Hey, I'm a newcomer. Hey, I'm a newcomer. Hey, I'm a newcomer. Hey, I'm a newcomer. I'm a newcomer. I'm a newcomer. I'm a newcomer. So they were like, shut up. Sit down and watch. The meeting's about to start. So I did, and I sat through that meeting, and they and people just surrounded me, and they were so good to me, and I was able to stay. And I've been ever since. I've been here ever since. And I really started taking sobriety serious. And at 2 years sober, it was time to move back to El Cajon because of my grandparents and my daughter. And it was time to, you know, a little bit more responsibility. So I moved to El Cajon. And now I'm in El Cajon. I think it was my 2-year birthday. It was so funny. Alcoholics Anonymous is hilarious. And I go to this meeting, right, and it's this little tiny room, it's crowded, and I'm new, and I'm at 2 years, I got a birthday, so I'm going to take my cake, you know. it's all about my ego, right? And I'm going to take my cake, and I go, and I stand there, and I'm like, blah, 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 you know, hi, I'm Linda, I'm an alcoholic, I have 2 years sober, and this girl runs up, and she's drunk, and she's like, you effing hoe, but she says it a lot more convincing to me, and I'm like, huh, and I could recover, and I'm like, you know, that was them, and then she comes back, anyway, so that was my, so I felt at home right away. It was awesome. Alcoholics Anonymous was alive and well in El Cajon as well as it was in North County, and I was really happy about that. And I found a new sponsor, a really lovely lady. People know her, Pat T. And she helped me a lot with that last, that one that I left off in that first four step, because I did a fourth and fifth step with her. And I had was able to go and talk about my mom more with her and work that out, because I couldn't see a part in it. I was like, I didn't have a part in that, because my mom would do, like, weird things. And, you know, I didn't have a part in that. And she helped me show that I did, you know. I perpetuated that. As soon as my mom, stopped, I continued it, you know, and that was my part. And I was able to forgive my mom and be able to, you know, live with a lot of the things that I don't know that I would have been able to continue to live with. So it's just like God is such a miracle in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it has put the exact people in my life that needs to be in my life. I have, gone through a lot of jobs. I went through a little spurt there where I kept getting fired, like four in a row, boom, boom, boom. And I worked in sales a lot, and I was making a lot of money in the beginning. Like, I went from MicroStar where I was making 80 grand, then I came out here and I started working for DirecTV, and I was making like 120 grand. And then I would find a job that, like, I ended up in car sales right at the, when the economy got bad. I'm like, sit in the car. Come on, you can pay for this. and there were sharks. I mean, it wasn't the, I could sell them, but it was like the other salespeople. Like, I was hiding behind cars, and, you know, it was bad. I was like, this isn't for me. And I had always thought, ever since I, you know, got sober, and the people that were so instrumental in my sobriety in the beginning were, you know, counselors. And I thought, you know, at that time I thought, well, I want to be a counselor. And everybody told me, no, you don't. You don't want to be a counselor. You know, they don't make any money. And in the back of my head, I always thought, you know, and in my heart, I always thought I want to be a counselor, drug and alcohol counselor. And then, so here I am, and, I'll rush this up. But I'm trying to keep my daughter sober. Now she's, you know, I don't know, what, she's 17 and just out there. And going to Mexico, and my grandmother was my grandpa had passed, and my grandmother was trying to live on alone when she really shouldn't be, and seeing angels, and I was like, you know, making sure that could be, you know, she could live, you know, without. And somebody asked me, how am I doing? And I'm like, oh, well, my grandma's this and my daughter's this, and they're like, well, we didn't even ask how you were doing. And I didn't even know. I hadn't been living my life for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I promptly said, you know what? I've been wanting to be a counselor. I quit that car job. And I had a motorhome that my grandpa had left me. It was a 74 Commander. And I moved to Campland on the bay. And I had like about like 3 months of, you know, funds to be able to do this, and I enrolled in school at City College to be a drug and alcohol counselor, and immediately I went to a meeting in El Cajon, and one of the members raises her hand for announcements, and she goes, we need a manager at the Salvation Army, and, you know, it doesn't pay much, but you get to live there, you know, rent-free, and then it's, you know, and it was right across the street from the school. So I took the job, and it was awesome. I mean, I was like, I knew I was on the right path again. Those seconds and inches and were happening all over. And that's just happened in my life. And it doesn't happen all the time. It's like almost like I'm going through this tunnel, and there's curves, and I can't see what's around, and I'm like going blind for a while. I'm kind of in that stage right now. And then all of a sudden, it just boom, boom, boom. You know, God just presents. And that's what happened. So I, you know, I'm a KDAC 2 now, and I have all that, and I... You know, I kind of just, God's just taking care of me, and it's through the people in these rooms that I hear the message, and I know that Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, and I mean, not only saved my life, but the program has made it to where I have a life. Like, I'm an alcoholic, and I don't even think, I shouldn't even be alive. I hear that sometimes and it doesn't register, but I really truly mean that. Like, I don't even think I should be alive or I should like my life because I wanted to die. And I think there's worse things than dying, you know. And I'm living a life. Like, I'm having a life. And I wake up in the morning and I'm happy and I have a purpose, you know, a primary purpose. And I'm just so grateful, and I thank all of you for hearing me for 45 minutes or whatever it was. Thank you.